This is Audible.
Justine, or The Misfortunes of Virtue, by Donatien Alphonse-François, Marquis de Sade. Translated by John Phillips, read by Nicholas Bolton and Polly Edsel for Naxos Audiobooks.
Oh, my friend, the rewards of crime are like the thunderbolt, whose deceptive fires embellish the skies for an instant, before plunging the unfortunate soul they have dazzled into the abyss of death. To my good friend. Yes, Constance, it is to you that I am dedicating this work, at once the example and honour of your sex, combining the fairest and most enlightened intellect with the most sensitive of natures. You alone can know those sweet tears shed by suffering virtue. Abhorring the sophistries of libertinism and irreligion, ceaselessly combating them by your words and actions, there is no risk that you will be offended by those employed by the characters of this story. Nor will you be upset by the cynicism of some passages, which have in any case been toned down as much as possible. Here, furious at being exposed, this is vice protesting when it is attacked. Tartuffe was put on trial by bigots. Justine will be decried by libertines, and I have little to fear from them. Once you have understood my motives, they will not be disavowed by them. My success depends on your opinion alone, and if you are happy, I may either enjoy universal success or bow to censure on all sides. The aims of this fiction, which is not as fictional as some might think, are doubtless new. The ascendancy of virtue over vice, good rewarded and evil punished, such is the general trend of works of this nature. Shall we ever tire of reading them? But everywhere to represent vice as triumphant, and virtue a victim of its attacks, to show a wretched girl wandering from one misfortune to another, the plaything of wickedness, the butt of every kind of debauchery, confronted with the most barbaric and most monstrous tastes, stunned by the most brazen and most specious sophistries, a prey to the most cunning of seductions, and the most irresistible of subornations, having no other defences against so many setbacks, so many scourges, so much corruption, but a sensitive heart, a mind formed by nature, and a great deal of courage, in short, to dare to write the boldest of descriptions, the most terrifying of maxims, all with the most energetic brushstrokes, with the sole aim of obtaining from all of this one of the most sublime moral lessons that humanity has ever been taught, was, I am sure you will agree, to reach this goal by a road seldom trodden before. Have I succeeded, Constance? Will a tear from your eyes confirm my victory? In short, having read Justine, will you say, oh, how these portraits of crime make me proud to love virtue. How sublime she is when she weeps. How beautiful she is in misfortune. Oh, Constance, these words need only escape your lips, and my labours are rewarded.
Part 1.
The greatest achievement of philosophy would be the elucidation of the means employed by Providence to achieve the ends which she has in view for man, and following this, the mapping out of conduct which might assist this unfortunate biped creature to find his way along life's thorny path, so that he may anticipate the strange whims of a destiny that is known by dozens of different names, and yet which he has still not managed to comprehend or define. If, filled with respect for our social conventions, and never straying beyond the limits they impose upon us, if, in spite of this, it is the case that we have encountered nothing but thorns, whilst wicked men gathered only roses, those lacking a properly established foundation of virtue to rise above this observation will doubtless conclude that it is better to let oneself be carried along by the current than to fight against it. Will they not say in such circumstances that however fair it may be, virtue is the worst option available when it is too weak to combat vice, and that in a century that is thoroughly corrupt, the safest course is to do as others do? With greater knowledge, in other words, and exploiting the insights they have acquired, will they not agree with the angel Jesrad in Zadig that there is no evil from which good does not come? and that accordingly they may indulge in evil, since it is in fact one more way of doing good. Will they not also conclude that it is indifferent to the great scheme of things whether an individual should prefer good or evil, and that if misfortune persecutes virtue and prosperity rewards crime, all things being equal in the eyes of nature, it is infinitely better to throw in one's lot with those evil men who prosper than with the virtuous who founder? It is therefore important to forestall these dangerous sophisms and the erroneous philosophy to which they belong, and essential to demonstrate that examples of unhappy virtue offered to a corrupted soul, which nevertheless retains a few virtuous principles, may bring this soul back to the path of righteousness, as surely as if he had been shown the path of virtue to be glistening with gold and to lead to the greatest rewards. It is doubtless cruel to have to depict a sweet and sensitive woman who is most respectful of virtue as the victim of countless misfortunes, and on the other hand, to show how those who oppress or mortify this same woman prosper. Yet, if one good thing should come from the depiction of these calamities, can one regret having described them? Can one regret the establishment of facts that teach the wise man who reads them the most useful lesson of submission to the will of Providence, and the fatal warning that it is often in order to remind us of our duties that heaven strikes down before our eyes those who seem to have most perfectly fulfilled their own? Such are the sentiments that will guide our work, and it is in consideration of these motives that we ask our readers' indulgence for the erroneous ideas which we shall put into the mouths of our characters, and for the, at times, rather shocking events which, out of love for truth, we have felt obliged to place before their eyes. Madame the Comtesse of Lorsange was one of those priestesses of Venus who owed their fortune to a pretty face and a great deal of misconduct, and whose titles, however pompous they may be, are to be found nowhere but in the archives of Cythera, shaped by their own impertinence and sustained by the stupid credulity of others. A brunette with a pretty figure, strikingly expressive eyes, and that fashionable incredulousness which, lending even more spice to the passions, makes those women in which it is suspected even more sought after. Some malice, no principles, believing nothing to be bad, and yet with not enough depravity in her heart to have extinguished all sensitivity. Proud. Libertine. Such was Madame de Lorsange. Nevertheless, this woman had received the best of educations. Daughter of a very important banker in Paris, she had been raised with a sister named Justine, 3 years her junior, in one of the most renowned convents of the capital, where until the ages of 12 and 15, no teachers or books or lessons had been denied to either sister. At a time so fateful for the virtue of both sisters, they lost all of this in a single day. A ruinous bankruptcy placed their father in such cruel circumstances that he died of grief. His wife followed him to the grave a month later. Two cold and distant relatives deliberated as to what they would do with the young orphans. Their share of an inheritance depleted by debts amounted to 100 écus each. Since no one cared to take charge of them, the doors of the convent were opened to them. They were given their inheritance, left free to do whatever they pleased. Madame de Lorsange, who from that time on called herself Juliette, and whose character and temperament would be no more developed at the age of 30, the age that she would reach during the course of the story that we are about to relate, appeared sensitive only to the pleasures of freedom, without giving a single thought to the cruel circumstances that had broken her chains. As for Justine, who, as we have said, was 12 years old, her serious and melancholy nature made her more aware of the full horror of her situation. Endowed with a tenderness and a surprising sensitivity, as opposed to the artfulness and guile of her sister, her innocence and candor would lead her into many traps. This young girl combined all of these qualities with the sweetest physiognomy, wholly different from that with which nature had adorned Juliette. There was as much modesty, decency, and timidity in the former's features as there was artifice, wile, and coquetry in the latter's. A look of the virgin, big, blue, soulful eyes filled with animation, a dazzling complexion, a shapely and supple figure, a voice to touch the heart, teeth of ivory, and the most beautiful blonde hair. Such was the portrait of this charming younger sister, whose innocent grace and delicate traits cannot be captured by our brushes. Both girls were given 24 hours to quit the convent, leaving it up to them how best to make provision for themselves with their 100 écus. Juliette, who was delighted to be her own mistress, was at first at pains to dry Justine's tears, but seeing that this was to no avail, she began to scold instead of consoling her. She reproached her for her sensitivity, telling her with a philosophical attitude quite mature for her age, that in this world one should worry only about what affected one personally, that it was possible to find within oneself physical sensations that were delicious enough to extinguish all moral feelings, the shock of which might otherwise be painful. That it was all the more essential to take this approach, in that true wisdom consisted infinitely more in doubling the sum of one's pleasures than in multiplying the sum of one's suffering. That in short, there was nothing one should not do to dull within oneself that perfidious sensitivity that benefited only others, while bringing oneself nothing but grief. However, it is difficult to harden a kind heart which resists the reasonings of an unkind intellect, and takes comfort from the satisfaction it enjoys by standing up to the sophistries of a wit. Employing other means of persuasion, Juliette then told her sister that the youth and looks enjoyed by both made it impossible for them to die of hunger. She cited the example of the daughter of one of their neighbors, who, having escaped from her father's house, was now kept in the lap of luxury, and was doubtless far happier than if she had remained in the bosom of her family. She warned her not to believe that a young girl could only be happy in the state of marriage, and that imprisoned by the laws of wedlock, she could look forward to few pleasures and a great deal of misery. On the other hand, if they surrendered to the joys of libertinism, they would always be able to defend themselves against their lovers' moods, or take consolation in multiplying their number. Justine was horrified by this speech. She said that she preferred death to ignominy, and in spite of the renewed efforts that her sister made to win her over, she persistently refused to stay with her, now that she saw her determined to behave in a manner that made her tremble. The two girls therefore separated, without promising to see each other again, seeing that their plans were so different. Would Juliette, who she claimed was going to become a great lady, be willing to take in a little girl whose virtuous but lowly inclinations might dishonour her? As for Justine, would she want to endanger her morals in the company of a perverted creature who would fall victim to dissoluteness and public debauchery? Both girls therefore bade each other a final farewell, and both left the convent the very next day. Cosseted in her childhood by her mother's dressmaker, Justine believes that this woman will be sensitive to her plight. She seeks her out, recounts her misfortunes to her, and asks for work, but is barely recognized and brutally dismissed. "Oh, heaven," the poor creature exclaims, "must even the very first steps that I take in this world be dogged by sorrows? This woman used to love me. Why does she reject me now? Alas, it is because I am a poor orphan with no resources, in a world in which people are esteemed only to the extent that they are thought to offer assistance and pleasure in return." A tearful Justine goes to see her priest. She describes her condition to him with all the innocence of her young age. She was wearing a little white dress, her beautiful hair carelessly tucked beneath a large bonnet. Her bosom could just be discerned, hidden beneath a few ells of gauze, her pretty complexion a little pale owing to the troubles that weighed upon her. Her eyes welled with tears, making them even more expressive. "As you can see, monsieur," she told the holy clergyman, "I am in a very distressing state for a young girl. I have lost my mother and father. God has taken them from me at the very age when I have most need of their help. They died penniless, monsieur. We have nothing left. This is all they left me," she continued, showing him her 12 louis, "with nowhere to rest my poor head. You'll take pity on me, won't you, monsieur? You are a minister of the church, and the church has always been the source of all that is good in my heart. In the name of the God that I adore, and whose representative you are, tell me as a second father what I must do, what I must become." Ogling Justine, the charitable priest replied that the parish was heavily burdened, that it would be difficult for it to take on new charity cases, but that if Justine were prepared to serve him, that if she were willing to do heavy work, there would always be a crust of bread for her in his kitchen. Saying this, God's spokesman slipped his hand into her cleavage, kissing her in a manner far too worldly for a man of the church. Well aware of his intentions, Justine rebuffed him with these words.
"Monsieur, I ask neither for charity nor for the place of a servant. I have far too recently left a condition above any in which I might feel obliged to aspire to either of these favours to be reduced to begging for them. I seek the counsel which my youth and misfortune demand, and you offer them to me at too high a price."
Embarrassed that his intentions had been exposed in this way, the priest threw the little creature out on the spot. Having now been twice rejected on the very first day of her solitary condition, the unfortunate Justine enters a house where she has seen a room's vacant notice, rents a little furnished room on the fifth floor, paying in advance, and gives vent to tears that her sensitivity and cruelly injured pride render all the more bitter. If our reader will permit, we shall leave her at this point for a while to return to Juliette, to relate how, from the simple state we saw her in, having no greater resources than her sister, she nevertheless became, over the course of 15 years, a titled lady with an income of 30,000 livres, the finest jewellery, 2 or 3 houses in both town and country, winning, for the time being at least, the heart, the fortune, and the trust of Monsieur de Corville, Councillor of State, a man enjoying the greatest credit and on the verge of becoming a minister. The road to riches was a thorny one, of that there is no doubt. Such ladies make their way by undergoing the harshest and most shameful apprenticeship. In the bed of a prince today, they may perhaps still bear the humiliating marks of the brutality of those libertines into whose hands youth and inexperience had caused them to fall. On leaving the convent, Juliette went to see a woman recommended to her by a young girlfriend in her neighbourhood. Perverted as she wished to be by this very same woman, she approached her with her little bundle under her arm, her blue coat in disarray, her hair dishevelled, the prettiest face in the world, if it be true that indecency can have charm in the eyes of some. She tells her story to this woman, and begs her to protect her, as she did her old friend.
"How old are you?" La Duvergier asks her.
"I'll be 15 in a couple of days, madame," Juliette replies.
"And has any mortal ever?" continued the matron.
"Oh, no, madame, I swear to you," replied Juliette.
"But sometimes in those convents," said the old woman, "a confessor, a nun, a companion? I need absolute proof."
"You are welcome to obtain it, madame," replied Juliette, blushing.
After the duenna had equipped herself with a pair of spectacles and scrupulously inspected everything from every angle, she said to the young girl,
"All right, then. You must stay here, pay close heed to my advice, demonstrate acceptance of and submission to my practices, keep yourself clean, be careful with money, honest with me, circumspect with your companions, and crafty with men. And within 10 years I shall make you wealthy enough to retire to a second-floor apartment with a chest of drawers, a pier-glass mirror, and a maid. And the skills you will have acquired from me will give you all you need to obtain the rest."
Having delivered this advice, Duvergier grabs hold of Juliette's little parcel. She asks if she has any money. Juliette is too honest to keep from her that she has 100 écus, with the result that dear Mama confiscates them, assuring her new tenant that she will invest this small sum in the lottery for her, but that young girls should not have money.
"It leads to evil doing," she tells her. "And in such a corrupt century as our own, a virtuous girl from a good background should take care to avoid anything that can ensnare her. What I am saying is only for your own good, my dear," added the duenna. "And you ought to be grateful to me for what I am doing for you."
When this sermon is over, the newcomer is introduced to her companions, and she is shown to her room in the house. The very next day, her virginity is on sale. In the space of 4 months, the merchandise is sold to a succession of nearly 100 people. Some are with the rose. Others, more refined or more depraved, for the question is not yet resolved, want to open up the bud that flowers next to it. Each time, Duvergier adjusts and closes them up again, and for 4 months the wicked woman is still offering her virginity to the public. At the end of this thorny novitiate, Juliette is finally granted her patents as a lay sister. From that moment on, she is accepted as a bona fide working girl, entitled from then on to a share of both the hardships and the profits. Another apprenticeship. Whilst, save for a few slips, Juliette serves nature in the first school, she forgets nature's laws in the second, where her morals are completely corrupted. The successes she sees vice achieve totally deprave her soul. She feels that, born to commit crime, she might as well go the whole hog instead of languishing in a secondary role which requires her to commit the same sins and to demean herself just as much, but does not bring her anywhere near the same rewards. A thoroughly debauched old gentleman likes her, and at first books her for a single appointment, but she is skillful enough to persuade him to keep her in great opulence. Eventually, she is seen at the theatre and opera, out walking alongside the leading lights of the Order of Cythera. People look at her, talk about her, envy her, and the smart creature plays the game so well that in less than 4 years she has ruined 6 men, the poorest of whom had an annual income of 100,000 écus. All of which was more than enough to make her reputation. Society people are so blind that the more one of these creatures has demonstrated her dishonesty, the more they long to be added to her list. It would seem that the degree of men's depravity and corruption becomes the measure of those feelings that they dare to show her. Juliette had just entered her 20th year when a certain Comte de Lorsange, a gentleman from Angers aged about 40, became so besotted with her that he determined to give her his name. He settled an annual income on her of 12,000 livres, bequeathing the rest of his fortune to her if he should happen to die before her. He gave her a house, servants, a livery, and the sort of standing in the world that in the space of only 2 or 3 years completely erased all memory of her origins. It was now that the wretched Juliette, forgetting all the moral values of her upbringing and education, perverted by poor counsel and dangerous books, in pursuit of pleasure alone, and determined to acquire a position in society and avoid a life in chains, dared to contemplate the crime of shortening her husband's life. Having once conceived this odious plan, she dwelt upon it, unfortunately making up her mind at one of those dangerous moments when the body is inflamed by moral weakness. Moments when nothing stands in the way of irregular or impetuous desires, so that one denies oneself all the less, and the intensity of the pleasures experienced is in proportion to the number of laws broken, or rather to their sanctity. If the dream vanished, and one became well-behaved again, the inconvenience would be small. Such is the history of those who make the wrong judgments. We know full well that they offend no one, but unfortunately, some go further. They dare to imagine what the realization of this idea would mean, since the very prospect of it has just enthralled and stimulated them so much. The accursed fantasy is made real, and its existence is a crime. Fortunately for her, Madame de Lorsange carried out her deed in such secrecy that she was safe from any retribution, and she saw to it that all traces of the dreadful crime that put her husband in the tomb were buried with him. A comtesse and free once again, Madame de Lorsange resumed her old habits. Believing that she now had a position in society, however, she conducted herself with a little less indecency. She was no longer a kept woman, but a rich widow who held fine dinner parties to which both court and town were only too glad to be invited. An upstanding woman, in other words, who could nonetheless be bedded for 200 louis, and who rented herself out for 500 a month. Before she reached the age of 26, Madame de Lorsange made many more brilliant conquests. She ruined 3 foreign ambassadors, 4 tax farmers, 2 bishops, a cardinal, and 3 knights of the king's orders. But as it is rare for one to stop at a first offence, especially when it has been successful, the wretched Juliette soiled her hands with 2 more crimes similar to the first. One of these was motivated by the theft of a considerable sum entrusted to her by one of her lovers, a sum of which his family had no knowledge, and which Madame de Lorsange was able to hide away as a result of this dreadful deed. She committed the second murder in order to get her hands quickly on a legacy of 100,000 francs, which one of her admirers bequeathed to the care of a third party, who was instructed to pass on this sum to her after his death.
Madame de Losange added 3 or 4 infanticides to these horrors. The fear of spoiling her pretty figure, the desire to hide a double intrigue, all of this made her resolve to stifle in her womb the consequences of her debauchery. And as these crimes, like the others, remained undiscovered, they did not prevent this clever and ambitious woman from daily finding new dupes. It is true, therefore, that prosperity can reward the very worst conduct, and that in the very midst of corruption and disorder, life can be filled with all that men call happiness, that the example of misfortune everywhere pursuing virtue, and which we shall presently offer to our reader, does not torment honest people any the more. The notion that crime flourishes is deceptive, being merely apparent. In addition to the punishment that is doubtless reserved by Providence for those seduced by its successes, do they not nourish in the depths of their soul a worm that ceaselessly gnaws away at them, preventing them from enjoying its false attractions, and in place of delight leaves in their soul only the heart-rending memory of the crimes that have brought them to this pass? As far as the unfortunate person persecuted by fate is concerned, he has his heart for consolation, and the inner joys that virtue gives him soon make up for the injustice of men. Such, then, was the state of Madame de Lorsange's affairs when Monsieur de Corville, aged 50 and enjoying the credit and consideration that we described above, resolved to sacrifice himself entirely for this woman, and to make her forever his. Whether by the attention he lavished upon her, or by various ploys, or because Madame de Lorsange decided that it was in her interests, he succeeded in doing this, and had been living with her to all intents and purposes as his legitimate spouse for 4 years, when the acquisition of a very beautiful property near Montargis required that both spend some time in this province. One evening, when the weather was so lovely that they decided to prolong their walk from their property as far as Montargis, they were both too tired to undertake the return journey on foot, and so they put up at the inn where the Lyon coach stops, intending to send a rider to fetch a carriage for them. They were resting in this inn in a cool room on the ground floor leading onto the yard, when the coach of which we have just spoken arrived at this hostelry. It is quite a popular entertainment to watch people getting off a coach. You can bet on the type of individuals inside, and if you've chosen a whore, an officer, a few priests, and a monk, you are almost sure to win. Madame de Losange gets up. Monsieur de Corville follows her, and both enjoy watching the company as they bump their way to the inn. It seemed that everyone had alighted from the carriage when a horseman of the mounted constabulary got out and then helped down one of his travelling companions, who had also been seated in the same place, a girl of 26 or 27, dressed in a simple little printed calico and wrapped from head to foot in a large cloak of black taffeta. She was tied up like a criminal, and was so weak that she would assuredly have fallen over if her guards had not supported her. Madame de Losange let out a cry of surprise and horror, whereupon the young girl turned around, revealing the most shapely of figures and the noblest, most pleasing and attractive of features. In other words, all of those charms most likely to please, rendered 1,000 times more piquant by that tender and touching sorrow that innocence adds to beauty's features. Monsieur de Corville and his mistress could not help being interested in this miserable girl. They approached and asked one of the guards what the unfortunate creature had done.
"She's accused of 3 crimes, the trooper replied. "Murder, theft, and arson. But I confess that my comrade and I have never transported a criminal with as much reluctance. She is the sweetest creature, and appears to be the most honest as well." "Oh," said Monsieur de Corville, "may it not just be a question of a few minor offences to be tried in the lower courts? And where did the crimes take place?" "In an inn a few leagues from Lyon. She was tried in Lyon, and now, according to custom, she is going to Paris for her sentence to be confirmed, and will return to Lyon to be executed."
Having drawn near to listen to this story, Madame de Losange whispered to Monsieur de Corville that she would like to hear the account of this girl's misfortunes from her own mouth, and Monsieur de Corville, who was forming the same wish, communicated it to the 2 guards, telling them who he was. The guards did not feel able to deny him. They thus decided that they should spend the night in Montargis, and requested suitable lodgings. Monsieur de Corville, having accepted responsibility for the prisoner, they untied her, and when she had been given a little food, Madame de Lorsange, who could not help taking the keenest interest in her, doubtless wondered to herself, "This creature who may be innocent is still treated like a criminal, while I am surrounded by prosperity. I, a woman who has soiled her hands with crimes and horrors." Having seen to it that the poor girl was somewhat refreshed and a little consoled by their attempts to comfort her, Madame de Lorsange charged her to tell them what had happened to place a girl with such a sweet countenance in such dire straits.
"To tell you the story of my life, madame," said the beautiful wretch, "is to offer you the most striking example of the misfortunes of innocence. It is to accuse the hand of heaven. It is to question the will of the supreme being. It is a kind of revolt against his sacred wishes. I dare not."
With that, this fascinating young lady began to weep floods of tears. After giving vent to her feelings, she began to recount her story in these words.
"You will allow me to conceal my name and my origins, madame. It may not be illustrious, but it is honest, and I could not have anticipated the humiliating circumstances in which you now find me. I lost my parents at a very young age. I hoped, with the little money that they had left me, to be able to secure a suitable position, and turning down all those that were not, I did not notice that I was spending the little I had living in Paris where I was born. The poorer I became, the more I was despised, the more I needed help, the less I hoped to obtain it. But of all the hardships I experienced at the beginning of my unhappy circumstance, of all the horrible propositions that were made to me, I will recount to you only what occurred at the house of Monsieur Dubourg, one of the richest merchants of the capital. The woman I was lodging with had referred me to him as someone whose wealth and credit were most likely to lessen the rigors of my situation. Having waited in this man's antechamber for some time, I was shown in. The 48-year-old Monsieur Dubourg had just left his bed and was wrapped in an ill-fitting dressing gown that barely concealed his disarray. His servants were on the point of doing his hair, but he sent them away and asked me what I wanted. "Alas, monsieur," I replied in confusion, "I am a poor orphan who is not yet 14 years of age, and who is already familiar with misfortune in all its aspects. I implore your sympathy. Have pity on me, I beg you." I proceeded to relate all of my ills to him, the difficulty I had had in finding a position, and perhaps even how hard I found it to accept one, not having been born into such a state. My misfortune in the course of my search to have run out of the little money I had, the lack of work, the hopes I entertained that he would provide me with the means of support. In short, all that the eloquence of misfortune dictates, and which is always more acute in a sensitive soul, always a drag on wealth. Having listened to me in a state of considerable distraction, Monsieur Dubourg asked me if I had always been a good girl. "I would be neither so poor nor so encumbered, monsieur," I replied, "if I had been ready to stop being one."
"But on what grounds," Monsieur Dubourg retorted, "do you expect the rich to ease your situation if you are unwilling to serve them in any way?"
"What kind of services do you speak of, monsieur?" I replied. "I am only too willing to render those services that my age and decency allow."
"The services of a child such as you are of little use in a household," Dubourg replied. "Neither your age nor your constitution befits you for the sort of work you are looking for. You would do better to set about pleasing men, and to make an effort to find someone who would consent to take care of you. This virtue that you make such a fuss about is of no use in the world. There's no point in kneeling before its altars, because its vain incense will not feed you. That which flatters men least, that which they consider to be of least importance, that which they despise the most intensely, is the virtue of your sex. In this world, my child, men value only those things that earn money or bring pleasure. What can we profit from the virtue of women? It is their waywardness that serves and entertains us, but their chastity could not be of less interest to us. When people like us give, in other words, it is only ever to receive. Now, how can a little girl like you repay what is done for her except by allowing others to use her body as they wish?
Oh, monsieur, I replied, my heart heavy with sighs. Do men no longer have any honesty or benevolence?
Very little, answered Dubourg. How can you expect them to when people talk about it all the time? We've got over this madness of obliging others for nothing in return. We've realized that the pleasures of charity were nothing more than the satisfactions of pride, and as nothing disappears so quickly, men started to want pleasures that were more real. We saw that with a child like you, for example, it was infinitely better to take all the pleasures offered by lewdness in return for one's charity than to give assistance for free, a cold and pointless process. The reputation of a liberal, charitable, generous man, even at the moment when he derives the most satisfaction from it, is not worth the least little pleasure of the senses.
Oh, monsieur, with such principles the unfortunate must surely perish.
What does it matter? France has more subjects than it needs. As long as the machine of state runs smoothly, what does it matter how many individuals it sustains?
But do you think that children respect their fathers when they are mistreated by them in this way?
What does a father care for the love of children that are a nuisance to him?
It would be better, then, if we'd been stifled at birth.
That is indeed the custom in many countries. It used to be the case in Greece, it still is in China, where unfortunate children are left out to die or are put to death. What's the point of allowing creatures to live who can no longer count on the support of their parents, either because they have been deprived of them, or because they have not been accepted by them, and who are nothing but a financial burden on a state that already has more than it can bear? Bastards, orphans, deformed children should be put to death at birth. The first and the second because, having no one who can or is willing to take care of them, they soil society with a scum that can only become fatal to it one day. And the others because they can be of absolutely no use to it. Both of these groups are, to society, like those fleshy excrescences that suck the sap from healthy branches, weakening and destroying them. Or, if you prefer, like those parasitical growths that attach themselves to healthy plants, eating away at them and damaging them by feeding on their nutritive seed. What flagrant abuses are those almshouses set up to feed such scum? Those richly endowed properties that we are extravagant enough to build for them. As if the human species were so rare, so precious, that we must preserve even its vilest examples. But let us leave aside a politics of which you will understand little, my child. Why complain of your lot when the remedy lies in your own hands?
Oh, heaven! At what price?
At the price of a fantasy, of a thing whose only value is that which your pride gives it. Moreover, this barbarian continued, rising to open the door, that is all I can offer you. Agree to it, or relieve me of your presence. I dislike beggars.
My tears flowed. I could not hold them back. Would you believe it, madame? They excited that man instead of moving him. He shut the door and, seizing me by the scruff of the neck, he brutally declared that he was going to force me to do what I would not grant him voluntarily. At that cruel moment, I took courage from my misfortune, eluded his grasp, and rushed to the door, saying as I escaped,
"Odious man! May the Lord, who is just as grievously offended by you as I am, punish you one day as you deserve to be punished for your execrable hardness of heart. You are worthy neither of the wealth that you so vilely exploit, nor of the very air you breathe in a world soiled by your barbarity."
I hastened to tell my landlady how I had been received by the person to whom she had sent me. But imagine my surprise when that wretched woman covered me with reproaches instead of sympathizing with my pain.
"Puny creature,"
she said to me angrily. "Do you imagine that men are so stupid as to give charity to a young girl like you without demanding interest for their investment? Monsieur Dubourg was too good treating you as he did. If I'd been in his shoes, I should not have let you leave my house without satisfying me. However, since you do not wish to take advantage of the help I am offering you, make your own arrangements as you please. Tomorrow, it's the money you owe me or prison."
"Have pity, madame."
"Oh, yes, pity. With pity, you die of hunger."
"But what do you want me to do?"
"You must go back to see Dubourg. You must satisfy him and bring me money. I shall see him and tell him to expect you. I will make up for your stupidity, if I can. I will apologize to him on your behalf, but you must try to behave better."
Shamefaced and in despair, not knowing where to turn, seeing myself cruelly repulsed on all sides and almost without resources, I told Madame de Roche, as my landlady was called, that I was ready to do anything to satisfy her. She went to see the financier, and upon her return told me that she had found him to be most annoyed, that she had had some difficulty winning him over, and that she had to resort to begging to persuade him to see me again the following morning. However, I should be careful how I behaved, because if I took it into my head to disobey him again, he would himself ensure that I was locked up for life. I arrived at Dubourg's house all of a flutter. Dubourg was alone, and in an even more indecent state than the day before. Brutality, libertinism, all the features of debauchery could be read in his shifty looks.
"You have Madame de Roche to thank," he said to me harshly. "It is only for her sake that I am willing, out of the goodness of my heart, to give you a second chance. You must be aware how unworthy you are of my benevolence after your conduct yesterday. Undress yourself, and if you offer the least resistance to my desires, two men are waiting in my antechamber to take you to a place you will never get out of alive."
"Oh, monsieur," I said in tears, throwing myself at the feet of this barbarous man. "Give way a little, I beg you. Be generous enough to help me without making me pay so high a price that I would rather offer you my life than submit to it. Yes, I prefer to die a thousand times rather than infringe the principles I learnt in my childhood. Monsieur, monsieur, do not force me, I beg you. Can you conceive of happiness in the midst of tears and disgust? Do you dare to seek pleasure where all you can find is repugnance? Immediately after committing your crime, the spectacle of my despair will fill you with remorse." But the infamies that Dubourg was already indulging in prevented me from continuing. How could I have thought myself capable of moving a man who was already finding my own pain yet one more stimulus for his horrible passions? Can you believe it, madame? His senses inflamed by the shrill tones of my cries, savouring them with inhumanity, the shameless man was already preparing to carry out his criminal actions. He rose to his feet, and revealing himself to me in a state in which reason rarely triumphs, in which the resistance of the object that drove him crazy merely served to feed his delirium, he brutally seized hold of me and hastily removed those veils that still hid from him what he longed to enjoy. One moment he abused me, the next he flattered me, treating me roughly, then caressing me. Oh, dear Lord, what a scene! What an unheard-of mixture of cruelty and lewdness! It seemed as if, in this first of my life's adventures, the Supreme Being wished to fill me once and for all with the horror I should have for the sort of crime that would lead to all of the ills that threatened me. But ought I to complain in that instant? Probably not, since it was to his excesses that I owed my salvation. Had he been less debauched, I should have become a dishonored woman. Dubourg's fires were extinguished in the very effervescence of his actions. Heaven avenged me for the insults to which the monster was intending to subject me, and the loss of his virility before he was able to sacrifice my virtue saved me from falling victim to him. This
made Dubourg all the more impudent. He accused me of being responsible for his weakness, and intended to make up for it with fresh outrages and even more mortifying invectives. There was nothing he said to me, nothing he attempted, nothing that his perfidious imagination, the harshness of his character and the depravity of his morals did not enable him to carry out. My clumsiness made him impatient. I was far from acting voluntarily. And I still feel remorse. And yet, nothing worked. He was no longer inflamed by my submissiveness. He tried in turn being tender and stern, proper and improper, my slave and my tyrant, but all in vain, for we both ended up exhausted, fortunately without his being able to recover sufficient strength to launch more dangerous assaults against me. He eventually gave up and made me promise to return the following day, and to make sure that I would do so, he gave me no more than the amount of money I owed to Madame Desroches. I therefore returned to that woman's house completely humiliated by such an incident and quite resolved, whatever might happen to me, not to expose myself to such things a third time. I warned her of this when paying her, cursing the villain capable of taking such cruel advantage of my misery. However, far from bringing the wrath of God down upon his head, my curses brought him nothing but luck. A week later, I learned that this notorious libertine had just obtained a general stewardship from the government that increased his income by more than 400,000 livres per annum. I was absorbed by the reflections to which such absurdities of destiny inevitably give rise, when a ray of hope appeared for an instant to shine before my eyes. One day, Madame Desroches came to tell me that she had finally found a household where I would be warmly welcomed as long as I behaved myself well.
"Oh, heaven, madame!"
I said to her, throwing myself joyfully into her arms.
"That is the very condition that I would lay down myself, and so, as you might imagine, I accept with pleasure."
The man I was to serve was a well-known Paris moneylender, who had got rich not just by lending at interest, but by robbing people with impunity whenever he thought he could get away with it. He lived in the Rue Quincampoix, on the second floor of a house, with a 50-year-old creature he called his wife, who was at least as mean-spirited as he was.
"Thérèse,"
this miser said to me, this being the name I had adopted to conceal my own.
"Thérèse, the first rule of my household is probity. If you should ever extort the tenth part of a denier from me, I would see you hang. Do you understand, my child? The little comfort my wife and I enjoy is the fruit of our hard labours and complete sobriety. Do you eat much, my child?"
"A few ounces of bread a day, monsieur," I replied. "Water and a little soup when I am fortunate enough to get any."
"Soup! My word, soup! Just listen to this, my dear,"
the moneylender said to his wife.
"Does not the ever-increasing demand for luxury make you weep? She's looking for a position. She's been dying of hunger for a year, and she expects to eat soup. We make soup barely once a week on Sundays, and we work like slaves. You shall have 3 ounces of bread a day, my girl, half a bottle of water from the brook, one of my wife's old dresses every 18 months, and 3 écus in wages at the end of the year, provided we are happy with your services, if your thrift lives up to our own standards, and if you help the household to prosper by dint of your good order and efficiency. If your work is poor, you can be dismissed in the blink of an eye. You need to clean and polish this 6-room apartment 3 times a week. Make our beds, answer the door, powder my wig, do my wife's hair, look after the dog and the parrot, run the kitchen, clean all the kitchen utensils, help my wife when she's making us a bite to eat, and spend 4 or 5 hours a day making linen, stockings, bonnets, and other little household items. As you can see, Thérèse, there's not much to do. You'll have plenty of time left over, which we will allow you to spend on yourself.
as long as you behave yourself, my child, are sober, and above all, economical. That's the main thing.
You can easily imagine, madame, that to accept such a position I had to be in the dreadful state I was in. Not only was there considerably more work than my strength could cope with, but could I live on what I was being offered? However, I was at pains not to appear difficult, and was hired on the very same evening. Although I should be thinking only of appealing to your sympathy, madame, if my cruel situation might entertain you for a moment or two, I might dare to tell you about some of the examples of avarice that I witnessed in that household. But in my second year of service, I was overcome by such a terrible catastrophe that I find it hard to dwell on amusing details before recounting my misfortunes to you. However, madame, I have to tell you that in Monsieur du Harpin's apartment, the only light was the one he borrowed from the street lamp that was happily positioned opposite his bedchamber. No one ever used any linen. The clothes I made were stored away and never touched. On the sleeves of Monsieur's jacket, and also on those of Madame's dress, an old pair of cuffs had been sewn onto the material, which I had to wash every Saturday evening. There were no sheets or towels in order to avoid the need for laundering. Wine was never drunk in the house, pure water being, according to Madame du Harpin, the drink that was both natural and least injurious to man's health. Whenever bread was cut, a basket had to be placed under the knife in order to collect any crumbs, which were then to be added to all the crumbs collected at mealtimes. This dish was fried with a little butter on Sundays, constituting the feast eaten on these days of rest. Clothes and furniture were never to be beaten for fear of wearing them out, but lightly dusted with a feather duster. Both Monsieur's and Madame's shoes were shod with iron. They were the same ones they had worn on their wedding day. An even stranger practice was that which I had to carry out each week. The apartment contained quite a large room whose walls were not papered. I had to scrape a certain amount of plaster from these walls with a knife and then filter this through a fine sieve. The result of this operation became the powder with which I dusted Monsieur's wig and Madame Chignon each morning. Oh, if only these turpitudes were the sole ones that these dreadful people indulged in! There is nothing more natural than the desire to conserve one's wealth and property, but it is not so natural to wish to increase it at the expense of others, and it was not long before I realized that this was how du Harpin acquired his wealth. On the floor above us lodged an extremely wealthy individual who possessed some very fine jewelry, and with whose belongings, whether because of the neighborhood or because they had passed through his hands, my master was well acquainted. I often heard him and his wife covet a particular gold casket containing between 30 and 40 louis, which, he would say, would have remained his had he only gone about matters with greater cunning. In the end, to console himself for giving back the casket, the good Monsieur du Harpin planned to steal it, and I was the one given the task of carrying out the theft. He lectured me at great length on the neutral consequences of theft, and even of its usefulness in the world, since it restored a kind of equilibrium which the inequalities of wealth completely undermined, and on the rarity of punishment, since it was demonstrable that barely 2 out of 20 thieves were executed. With an erudition of which I would not have believed Monsieur du Harpin capable, he demonstrated that theft was honored throughout Greece, that there were still peoples that accepted it, favored it, and rewarded it as an act of both skill and courage, 2 virtues essential to any warlike nation. In short, he made much of the credit which would get me out of trouble if I was discovered. Monsieur du Harpin gave me 2 skeleton keys, one of which would open the neighbor's apartment, and the other the writing desk containing the box in question. He instructed me to bring him this casket immediately, promising that in return for such an important service, my wages would be increased for 2 years by an additional écu.
"Oh, monsieur,"
I cried, trembling at this proposition.
"How can a master dare to corrupt his servant in such a manner? What is to stop me from turning against you the very weapons you are placing in my hands? And how could you object if one day I made you victim of your own principles?"
Du Harpin, in confusion, took refuge in a clumsy subterfuge. He told me that his intention was merely to test me, and that it was lucky for me that I resisted his temptations, that I would have been done for had I succumbed to them. I scoffed at this lie, but I soon realized that it was wrong of me to give such firm responses. Evildoers do not like to meet resistance in those they seek to seduce. There is unfortunately no middle ground once one is unfortunate enough to have become the object of their attentions. From that point on, one is obliged to become their accomplice, which is dangerous, or their enemy, which is more dangerous still. If I had had a little more experience of the world, I should have left the house that instant. But it was already written in heaven that every honest impulse that would spring from my heart would meet with misfortune. Monsieur du Hautpin let nearly a month go by, that is, virtually to the end of my second year in his house, without saying a single word or manifesting the slightest resentment at my refusal of his proposal, when one evening, having just retired to my room to enjoy a few hours' repose, I suddenly heard my door being forced open and, not without some trepidation, saw Monsieur du Hautpin, accompanied by a police superintendent and four soldiers of the watch, standing before my bed.
"Do your duty, monsieur,"
he said to the officer of the law.
"This wretched woman has stolen a diamond from me worth 1,000 écus. You will find it in her room or on her person, that's for sure."
"I steal from you, monsieur," I said, jumping out of bed in a state of shock. "Me? Oh, heaven! You know better than anyone that this is not the case. Who could be more aware than yourself how repugnant such an action would be to me, and that it is not possible for me to have committed it?" However, making a lot of noise so that I could not be heard, du Hautpin continued to give orders for my room to be searched, and the fateful ring was discovered under my mattress. There was no answer to such irrefutable proof, and I was immediately seized, bound and led away to prison without having a chance to say one word in my defence. The trial of an unfortunate girl without either influence or protection is soon expedited in a land where virtue is thought incompatible with misery, and where misfortune is sure proof of guilt. In such places, unjust imprisonment on suspicion can persuade a court that the person who must have committed the crime did commit it. Opinions match the state in which the accused find themselves, and if there is no gold or securities to establish that they are innocent, the impossibility of their innocence is determined once and for all. In vain did I defend myself or extend the best assistance to the duty lawyer to whom I was briefly allowed access. The accusation came from my master, the diamond had been discovered in my room, and it was clear that I had stolen it. When I attempted to draw attention to Monsieur du Hautpin's frightful character to prove that the misfortune that had befallen me was nothing but the fruit of his vengefulness and the result of his desire to be rid of a creature who, knowing his secret, was acquiring power over him, these charges were treated as recriminations, and I was told that Monsieur du Hautpin had been known for 20 years as a man of integrity who was incapable of such a dreadful act. I was transferred to the Conciergerie, where I realized I was about to pay with my life for my refusal to be party to a crime. I was going to die, and only another criminal act could save me. Providence dictated that crime should serve at least once as virtue's shield, saving it from the abyss into which it was about to be plunged by the imbecility of the judges. In the cell next to me was a woman of about 40, who was as famous for her beauty as for the nature and multiplicity of her misdeeds. Her name was Dubois, and like the unfortunate Thérèse, she was about to be sentenced to death, the only concern of the judges being the manner of her execution. Since she was guilty of all imaginable kinds of crime, they almost felt obliged either to invent some new punishment for her, or to subject her to one from which our sex is normally exempt. I had inspired a kind of interest in this woman, no doubt of a criminal nature, since, as I was to discover later, it was motivated by a strong desire to make a proselyte of me. One evening, perhaps 2 days at the very most before the day when both of us were due to hang, Dubois told me not to go to bed and, without attracting attention, to wait with her as close as possible to the prison gates.
"Between 7 and 8 o'clock," she continued, "I have arranged for the conciergerie to catch fire. Many people will doubtless be burnt to death, but this is of no consequence, Thérèse."
This wicked woman had the